Support for the World's podcast comes from Goldman Sachs. To learn about developments currently shaping markets, industries, and the global economy, subscribe to the firm's podcast, Exchanges at Goldman Sachs, available on iTunes and Stitcher.
The crisis in Venezuela hits home today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. The BBC's Vladimir Hernandez recently returned to his native Venezuela. He wanted to report on the food shortages, and then he checked in on his parents.
I met my mum, and she was so skinny that I was shocked just looking at her. I met my dad, who I hadn't seen in like 4 years, and I could see his cheekbones.
Plus, should former members of the U.S. military wade into politics?
If they want to enter into the political arena, then they should. But when you enter into the political arena, there are no rules.
And a Syrian goes from refugee in Europe to Olympian in Rio.
She is so excited to be there. This is a dream come true. This is something that she never imagined would happen.
Those stories today on The World. As journalists, our job is to report on the news in an objective way, even when the stories we're telling are difficult to hear, or when the pain felt by those in the news is obvious. It's harder, sometimes even impossible, to maintain that professional distance when a reporter knows some of those affected. That's what happened to my colleague Vladimir Hernandez. He's a Latin America correspondent for our partners at the BBC. He's usually based in London, but he recently traveled to his native Venezuela to report on the economic crisis there, specifically the lack of food in many parts of the country.
Well, it's a big food distribution crisis. There are a lot of shortages, and it's a country with the highest inflation in the world. In many places, people are not getting enough. And when there is food available, it just costs so much that no one can buy it.
And remind us why Venezuela is in this crisis. It just seems so extreme for a country that historically has had a strong economy. It's an oil economy. What brought Venezuela to this point?
The main issue Venezuela has had is that it is a state in which the expenditure grew at a really fast pace. And this was to finance either social programs, state spending, infrastructure, all sorts of programs that when the price of oil went down, and that just essentially cut about 2/3 of the income of the country, the spending structure was completely unsustainable. And now the Venezuelan government is just facing the inability of paying the bills, even basic bills, to import food. But if you speak to anyone in the opposition camp of politics, they will also point their fingers at the state becoming the main player in a market and making it less profitable for private companies to actually produce anything because the state just took over everything, essentially.
Vladimir, you're Venezuelan, and I understand this story got very personal for you. When you visited, you learned that not only are many Venezuelans struggling with not enough to eat and not enough food, you found it in your own family there. What happened?
Well, that was very strong, very emotional in many ways. I met my mum, and she was so skinny that I was shocked just looking at her. I met my dad, who I hadn't seen in like 4 years, and I could see his cheekbones, and my dad has always been like a very robust man. My brother was telling me he had already downsized his trousers, his pants, one size, and you can see how skinny he was. And I mean, I'm not talking about African famine here or any sort of extreme malnutrition, but the fact that a lot of people who I know on a personal level, my family, friends, had just lost so much weight was, I think people there just don't realize that. I think you just have to stop seeing people. And when you see them again a year later and you see everyone's lost weight, well, there's clearly a problem here.
What do your family members say in terms of what they think is going to happen? I mean, are they angry? Are they hopeful? Do they have confidence that the government will solve this crisis?
Look, there's been shortages in Venezuela since at least 2006. But the fact that it's gotten worse throughout the years and not necessarily abruptly, I think I come back with the idea that a lot of people have become used to the struggle. People to tell you, well, you know, I've just got a queue. That's all I have to do. I've just got to get in line and get my food. It's not something that is shocking. A lot of people find it despairing, but they've become accustomed to it. And in a way, probably that's why it keeps on happening. And a lot of people will ask you outside of Venezuela, so how come there's no social revolt? How come people just don't take the streets or anything? This is what's been happening. And it's been trickling through in recent years. And maybe people in a way have just gotten used to it and don't see a solution. Also, there may be an element of fear in a way that In the last time there were huge protests in Venezuela related to the economy, it was in 2014, about 2 years ago. And after that, there was a big crackdown on a lot of university students who took part in it. Some of them are still in jail. And I think that kind of had an impact on many Venezuelans.
In the video you shot, there's these long, long lines. You know, they practically go for a mile, people waiting in line. The situation seems unsustainable.
It definitely is. And also, I don't think a lot of people know what does it take to buy food in Venezuela right now. Any Venezuelan can only go once a week to a supermarket or to a shop to buy something. And that all depends on what's the number in which your national identity card finishes with. So if you are, let's say, 0 and 1 in the last digits of your national identity card, that means you can only buy on a Monday. And that means that you can only go there on Monday to buy a fixed amount of goods. So you can only buy, for instance, 1 pack of flour, 1 pack of pasta, and 2 bottles of water. You cannot really stock yourself up waiting for the next wave of food to arrive. Sometimes it's very humiliating. People wait in line and then you have to get a number branded on your arm, which will tell you what's your turn in the queue. And some of the scenes I saw were just extremely sad, because I saw people at 3 a.m. under heavy rain just waiting in line, hoping to get something, and people who had been waiting and then at the end of the day couldn't get anything.
And you yourself were interrupted by authorities when you tried to videotape what was going on in a supermarket. It seems to me that there's some concern by the government that they don't want this exposed.
We went into a supermarket because we saw that there were signs of a riot about to erupt, because the supermarket was closed and people had been there since 2 a.m. and this was about 4 p.m. and a lot of people were not able to buy food. So there was a riot in the making there. And as soon as we got in, even with small cameras, the National Guard just essentially surrounded us and kicked us out. But while they were doing that, everybody around us started chanting, let them film, because they just wanted their story being told. They thought that if this was getting on cameras, things would be better. And that was such a desperate situation.
Where do you think Venezuela is headed? I mean, it's hard to believe this thing can go on forever. Is there some sort of punctuation mark? Like, is there a time where there'll be a new election and Nicolas Maduro could be defeated? What's the next step here?
I think the electoral solution is still very much on the cards in Venezuela, because Nicolas Maduro is still halfway through his term. And if you're queuing under the rain at 3 a.m. and not being able to find enough food, the fact of thinking that you still have 3 more years of the same government to go, a lot of people just wouldn't take that.
Have many Venezuelans left the country?
I spoke to a young student called Valeska, and she was telling me that she just wanted to go to a place which was normal, where she would be able to go to a supermarket and decide when and what to buy with the money she had, and therefore she left for Mexico. So it is very recurrent that you see young people leaving the country right now.
Vladimir Hernandez is Venezuelan. He's the Latin America correspondent for the BBC in London, and he just returned from a visit to Venezuela. Thanks, Vladimir.
Thank you.
We stay in Latin America for our next story. It comes to us from the southern Mexican state of Oaxaca. A cultural festival just wrapped up earlier this week called the Guelaguetza. It's a big deal for the state's local economy, drawing visitors from around the globe. But many people in Oaxaca prefer another celebration that takes place in the state, an alternative festival known as the People's Guelaguetza. Shannon Young has our story from Oaxaca City.
From a distance, this street procession of dancers in regional costumes, brass and wind musicians, and giant puppets looks like many traditional parades known here as calendas. Then you see the banners with slogans like No Forgiveness, Nor Forgetting, and you hear the chants calling for the release of political prisoners. This is the People's Guelaguetza. You won't hear chants like that or see protest banners at the official version of the event. The state-sponsored Guelaguetza is a carefully stage-managed showcase of local cultural traditions. Ticket prices start at the equivalent of $50, way out of reach for many people in Oaxaca. Some free tickets are available, but you have to stand in line for hours to get one. The People's Guelaguetza, on the other hand, is completely free and organized mainly by a dissident teachers union that's been battling the government for years. Salvador Aquino is a teacher and a member of the delegation of dancers and musicians representing the town of Miahuatlán de Porfirio Díaz in this year's alternative festival.
Creo que es necesario rescatar el verdadero sentido de lo que es la Guelaguetza. I think we need to rescue the real meaning behind the Guelaguetza. It's not about the commercialization and selling of the indigenous person as a registered trademark. The Guelaguetza is the act of sharing. I'm sharing my dance moves and my music with others. And that's what this is all about, coming together as brothers and sharing.
The word Guelaguetza is Zapotec for a system of mutual aid and generosity that plays a crucial role in the social fabric of many indigenous communities. The public's role in sharing back is most apparent in the calendas held in the run-up to the main People's Guelaguetza event. The teacher-organized processions are marathon street parties that snake through downtown neighborhoods and gather thousands of participants over the course of hours. Some area residents line the streets to applaud. Others throw candy or confetti from their balconies. Many join the revelers, offering mezcal in tiny plastic cups to fellow parade-goers. A few even stake out corners and hand out free food as the procession goes by.
Les repartimos arroz colorado con dos huevos duros, salsa verde.
Yaneri Castro and two helpers parked along the parade route and served up tacos of hard-boiled eggs and seasoned rice to anyone who wanted them. They're part of an environmental club for elementary school-aged children and their parents in the nearby city of Villa de Sachila. Castro says they made enough food for 500 people, paid for by donations sent by Oaxacan migrants living in the U.S. She says sharing food is a way to support those who come to the festival from afar, but also those who've been part of the protest movement since it started years ago, so that they don't give up the fight. The fight Castro is referring to is an ongoing struggle over a series of free market structural reforms that are being implemented by Mexico's federal government, especially one that is supposed to make Mexican teachers more accountable. Dissident teachers in the largely indigenous states of Oaxaca, Chiapas, Guerrero, and Michoacán have been protesting the measure for years now, and with particular intensity in recent months. The demonstrations turned deadly in mid-June after state and federal police opened fire while attempting to clear a highway blockade near the town of Nochixlán in Oaxaca's indigenous Mixteca region. The death toll depends on the source, but between 8 and 11 people were killed. This teacher from Nochixlán, who spoke on condition of anonymity, says the massacre sparked a debate within the union local about whether or not to organize a People's Guelaguetza this year. He says people worried that holding the alternative festival would be like mocking the dead. But in the end, organizers concluded that going ahead with the event was a way of paying homage instead. The killings in Nochixlán added a new set of demands to the conflict between the dissident teachers and the federal government. Negotiations continue, though a quick resolution seems unlikely. It's unclear at this point if the dispute will affect the start of the new school year later this month. But at least for the duration of the People's Guelaguetza, the teachers shifted their protest tactics to shore up social connections and celebrate Oaxaca's rich cultural heritage without charging an entry fee. For The World, I'm Shannon Young in Oaxaca, Mexico.
A quick look ahead now before the break. We've got a story about a high-end burger chain in Britain that got raided recently by immigration authorities. Several workers ended up getting deported, and protesters have taken matters into their own hands.
I met a group of activists who then headed to two of their restaurants and released thousands of insects, so locusts, crickets, beetles, cockroaches, in two of the restaurants.
Bugs and burgers. That's coming up in just a few minutes. You're listening to The World. Mexico has a big corruption problem. In fact, last year, the group Transparency International ranked Mexico high on its list of most corrupt countries. But there's an effort to turn things around in Guadalajara, the country's second biggest city. It won't be easy, given how endemic corruption is in Mexico. That's according to Duncan Tucker, who reports for The Guardian out of Guadalajara.
Well, it's something that affects almost every aspect of life here in some way. It can be in day-to-day kind of business, or it can be a much higher level. To give a couple of examples from the investigations that I've been doing, one case was where a local woman, her son had disappeared. And when she went to report the disappearance, the police officers actually asked her to fund the investigation. Essentially, they wanted a bribe just to do their job. And she ended up paying out several thousands of dollars worth of money, and they didn't even end up finding her son in the end.
So Guadalajara is trying to fight against corruption, and I guess it started with the election of this new Citizens Movement Party. What is that party, and how did it come to power?
So it's been around for a few years now. The current mayor, he first began as a mayor of a smaller town just on the outskirts of Guadalajara. And that was kind of an experiment for him. And it went really well. He transformed it from one of the least transparent governments in Mexico to actually the number one local government in terms of transparency, according to one Mexican NGO, which studies these kind of things. So that helped him gain the trust of the people. And then he ran for the mayor of Guadalajara last year and won. He's been pretty popular so far. I think people are, they've noticed a certain change, I think, as beforehand, the city had been governed by the PRI and the PAN, Mexico's two biggest parties, for almost 100 years now. So I think they were really looking for change. And I think they started to see some improvements.
Have those efforts already made a difference in terms of the level of corruption?
It's a big challenge. It's not going to change overnight, but it's a start at least. I think more than anything, it's in the way that people perceive the government as well. At least they've changed the image slightly of government and kind of given people the hope that they can start to tackle these things. There are some practical measures that they've taken. They've fired several local policemen that they found to be corrupt. The taxes, for example, they have started voting on what to spend the taxes on, and certain projects have received funds because of that. So there are small advances being made, but it isn't something that you can just change within a year. It'll take many, many years, if not generations, to completely eradicate this kind of corruption, which is so endemic in Mexico at the moment.
So who is this new mayor, and how's he been received?
So he's been around for a while. He actually started out in Mexico's PRI, the governing party, a long time ago, 20, 30 years ago, which was basically the only party in Mexico at the time. He's been well known in this area for about 5 years now, since he became mayor of the smaller town I mentioned earlier. And it's quite likely that once his term runs out in 3 years' time, he'll try running for the state governorship again. And I imagine with the extra support that he will have gathered over the last couple of years, I think he's quite likely to become the next governor of this state.
I understand he's used new technology as part of his efforts. What's he done?
So yes, he recently launched a Ciudad app, which means city app in Spanish. And it's an application that allows citizens all across the city to report any problems that they encounter, from broken street lamps or potholes to acts of crime and that kind of thing. And it allows those reports to go straight to the mayor's office, and they can then begin to resolve them. Whereas before, they would have to report these kind of things to the police or the attorney general's office, which is quite a long and slow and complicated process, which puts many people off actually denouncing crime.
Has there been any kind of blowback to the mayor's efforts, given that he's using new technology? And in the earlier case of the tax thing, he's really asking for advice from property taxpayers.
There has been some criticism, especially with the taxes, because in this case, it's not everyone that pays taxes that is allowed to vote on what that money's spent on. It's only people that pay property taxes. Some people have criticized it as a kind of elitist measure, which is actually more regressive than progressive, because it takes it back to a kind of feudal age where it's only the landowners that have a say. So it is something that's been a bit controversial. And again, with the app, it's something that people with smartphones and access to this technology, only those people are able to use it. Obviously, there is quite wide coverage of smartphones nowadays in Guadalajara. But again, it's the very poorest people won't be able to afford that kind of phone. They won't necessarily have access to this.
The Guardian's Duncan Tucker in Guadalajara. Thanks, Duncan.
Okay, thanks very much.
We like our burgers and fries fast. And our next story is about the workers that made that happen at a high-end burger joint in London. Several immigrant employees at a Byron Hamburgers franchise were deported after a raid last month. And protesters are angry about how the company handled the raid. Journalist Michael Segaloff in London wrote about it for Huck magazine.
The allegations are that staff in 12 of these restaurants across London were called into meetings early one morning, which were ostensibly for health and safety reasons, or others say it was for training on a new burger. But rather than that meeting actually taking place, immigration officials swooped in and started checking people's identities.
Who are the people protesting against it?
There seems to be a kind of a huge amount of frustration and outcry, really. On Twitter, this hashtag Boycott Byron was doing the rounds and quite a lot of traction. The trade unions that represent the staff, but generally just the general public. I think there seems to be a real feeling of frustration and discontent that an employer can go around getting away with this sort of thing.
So I understand these protesters did something quite dramatic. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so on Friday evening last week, I got a text on the Thursday tipping me off there was going to be some form of action taking place at two of the restaurants. And on Friday night, I met a group of activists in a square in London who then headed to two of the restaurants and released thousands of insects, so locusts, crickets, beetles, cockroaches, in two of the restaurants.
These were Byron Hamburger restaurants that were open and had customers in them?
Yeah, there were customers there. We were sort of told to go to one of them. We sat down with my photographer sort of with his camera in his bag, because obviously he didn't want to draw too much attention to ourselves. And then, yeah, after about 10 or 15 minutes of sitting down, I looked at the table next to me, which was now empty, and heard a shriek from around the corner, and there were thousands of beetles poking about. Customers had to leave, and the restaurant's forced to shut.
So are all Byron hamburger joints shut down now, or just a few?
No, I think everything's back open. There was a large protest outside one of the other restaurants in central London yesterday, where the restaurant was just shut for the afternoon.
And how many people were affected? How many people lost their job?
It seems to be that 35 people have been detained by the Home Office after these raids, the majority of which, and we don't have the exact figures, have already been deported out of the country.
Has there been a noticeable uptick in raids on restaurants like Byron Hamburgers?
This seems to be the first of its kind. There's certainly been immigration raids taking place before and after the vote to leave the European Union. Theresa May, the new Prime Minister here, was the Home Secretary before she took up her office, and was a big believer in trying to tackle immigration, going really hard. There was stories of, go-home vans being driven around areas with large amounts of migrants, kind of allegedly, and seems to be hiking up racial tension. Whether or not this is specifically related to that, it remains unclear and hard to say, but certainly its timing is significant. And I would say also that, the releasing of bugs into these restaurants isn't just an act of protest, although it did achieve its goal. The activists also saying and drawing comparisons with the way that migrants and refugees have been described by both the media and politicians. David Cameron, before he resigned, referred to, during Prime Minister's questions actually, migrants and refugees as being a swarm, a phrase which has huge amounts of connotations. Katie Hopkins, who's a well-known controversial columnist here for one of the UK's largest newspapers, referred to refugees as cockroaches in an article just a few months ago. So there's definitely some symbolism here that is worth noting too.
All right. Michael Segalov is a journalist in London. He's been telling us about the raid on the Byron Hamburger franchise. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, we ask a vet whether or not former military personnel should get actively involved in political campaigns. His answer might surprise you. Stick around. You're with The World. I'm Carol Hills. Yusra Mardini is from Syria.
She was living a normal life like any other teenager.
But then she fled the war and ended up swimming ashore on the Greek island of Lesbos.
And she was just cold, wet, shivery. And when she got to shore, she kissed the ground.
Now she's swimming in the Olympics. Yusra's story's ahead here on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Carol Hills, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Khazir Khan kicked off days of political debate with his speech at the Democratic Convention last week. He's the father of a fallen Muslim-American soldier. Khan said that Donald Trump has never sacrificed for his country. Now there's another political controversy bubbling away that relates to the military. Yesterday, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the nation's top military officer, had a message for all active duty service members. Marine Corps General Joe Dunford said that they should remain apolitical and nonpartisan. Then a former chairman of the Joint Chiefs, General Martin Dempsey, went a step further. He said retired generals and admirals should not speak out about those seeking office. This on the heels of a retired general, John Allen, appearing on stage at the Democratic Convention to denounce Donald Trump. Tim McLaughlin is a former Marine who served in Iraq in 2003. He's now an attorney in New Hampshire. Tim, what did you think when General Allen spoke in Philadelphia?
Well, I should tell you first that General Allen was my commanding officer in 2000 when I was at the basic school. And people then, and I think still today, have enormous respect for him. When I see someone like General Allen, I think it's important for him to be able to express his opinion, given the way the political discourse has developed. I worry, however, that whether it's General Allen speaking with Hillary Clinton or other generals speaking with Donald Trump, that that takes away from the actual sacrifices that are being made by our young men and women who leave behind Blue Star families and Gold Star families.
In what way?
My experiences in 2003 did not have anything to do with the politics at the time. They had to do with young men and women who sign up to fight for their country and defend it. It doesn't have to do with politics. It has to do with real-life decisions that destroy families here and at home, and it frustrates me when I see the co-option of my and my service members' experiences for political gain. That is frustrating to me.
Do you think that's what was going on with having Mr. Khan speak about his son?
No, I think Mr. Khan's son sacrificed his life for our country. So I don't think that's what was going on for Mr. Khan.
But what about the Clinton campaign?
Right. I think that the Clinton campaign was delighted that Mr. Khan would be willing to share his family's pain with the Democratic Party. And you can assume that I vote, but it's important to me that I separate who I vote from the pain I experience as a military person. So I think they also knew when they stepped onto that stage that they were entering into a political discourse. Donald Trump's comments about the Khan family may or may not be verboten. We'll find out in November. But that is the danger when you enter into the political conversation and inject true sacrifice the way Captain Khan made and the way his family feels. That said, I think what the Khan family did was noble and important to inject it, but there are consequences to be prepared for in that political dialogue.
I'm not a service member. Are there hard and fast rules about how former or current members of the military should comport themselves?
You would have been better served to ask me 10 years ago when I got out. I know that the baseline rule is that active duty military personnel should not involve themselves publicly in the political discourse. Obviously, we all vote. We all have opinions. We share them with our family members and friends. But it's very dangerous when active duty service members affiliate with political parties because it gives the appearance that the Marine Corps, the Army, or the Navy, or the Coast Guard favors this point of view or that point of view. And it, as you see, even in the most recent events of this world 2 weeks ago, it is dangerous when the military starts picking political sides.
What are you referring to?
I'm referring to Turkey.
Oh, of course. What about members of the military who are not in active duty?
Members of the military who are not in active duty, I think, have an obligation first to themselves and the people they served with. And then if they can find a way to help the country understand what their experiences have been, then they should. And if they want to enter into the political arena, then they should. But when you enter into the political arena, there are no rules. The political party's goal is to get elected. And if they can get elected by diminishing a service member's experience, they will. And if they can get elected by cherishing a service member's experience, they will. But my experience is most politicians' first goal is to be elected, and everything else is secondary.
Tim McLaughlin is a former United States Marine living in New Hampshire. Thanks so much, Tim.
Thank you for your time.
Very few Americans question the idea that the U.S. military should be subservient to the nation's political leaders, with the president as their commander-in-chief. But in other parts of the world, generals and armies meddle in politics all the time. So how exceptional is the U.S.? The world's one-man history desk, Chris Wolf, joins me in the studio now. And Chris, how did the American exceptional circumstances here come about?
Well, it was enshrined right from the beginning in the Constitution that the president is the commander-in-chief, that a civilian is in charge of the military. But why? And I always enjoy reminding people that the founding fathers were very keen students of history, ancient and modern, and were well aware that the biggest threat to a republic, and we shouldn't forget how unique the United States was in just choosing not to have a king in the 18th century, that the biggest threat to a republic historically is a military dictatorship.
So what kind of examples do you think the Founding Fathers were alluding to?
Well, they wrote and spoke a lot about the ancient world, the ancient Greeks, and more especially about ancient Rome, which was a republic long before it was an empire. They loved these ancient examples of democracy and republican virtue. There's a reason Washington, D.C. is full of classical architecture. But they were well aware that the Greeks fell prey to their tyrants and that the Roman Republic was effectually destroyed by Julius Caesar, a hugely successful general with huge ambitions. Now, he was assassinated, of course, by backstabbing politicians in the Senate. But within a generation, you know, his relatives had replicated his success and effectively destroyed the republic and democratic ideals.
But the Founding Fathers must have been looking beyond the classical period. I mean, gosh, that was a long time ago.
Yeah, I mean, it was inspiring, but their more immediate model was what the you might call the mother country, England, in the 1600s, which had a lot of civil wars, and for part of which the Puritans won and established a republic. But their top general, Oliver Cromwell, pretty soon got tired of all the dickerings of the politicians and himself established a military dictatorship, which was hugely unpopular. And a lot of people who moved from England after that took that memory with them about how standing armies were bad. And then there's another example, not so well known, which is the King of France, who Louis XIV established an absolute monarchy with a huge standing army, which was used to take away individual liberties and persecute religious minorities, such as the Huguenots, many of whom ended up moving to America, including the ancestors, as you may know, of Paul Revere.
What about more contemporary examples? I mean, we look at the U.S., you know, Canada. There's a bunch of countries that certainly don't have the military off in the sidelines kind of breathing down their neck. What are some contemporary examples that do?
In Turkey, the military has a constitutional right to safeguard democracy, hence all the coups there. And of course, now with the new changes in Turkey, that could well be changing. And then elsewhere, generally, military coups are illegal, but they happen because, you know, a general might think that he has the best interests of the country at heart, but quite often it's just naked ambition.
So how exceptional is the U.S.?
Well, I always point to the example of Latin America. In the generation after the American Revolution, the colonies of Spain threw off the control of Spain largely, and the ideals of the Enlightenment of military subservience to the civilian authority and all that were just as strong in Latin America, but strong men would come along, successful generals, and establish dictatorships because, again, a mixture of ambition and, you know, what they thought was the best interests of their particular country, you know, there's no reason to suppose that that couldn't have happened here.
Has the U.S., through its history, ever been close to having a military coup?
Absolutely. There was quite a few occasions during the American Revolution when, you know, the long-suffering soldiers of the Continental Army would talk about taking matters into their own hands. And in fact, George Washington himself was instrumental in putting down perhaps the only real threat to American democracy from the military, which was in right at the end of the Revolutionary War. The army was all based around Newburgh, New York, on the Hudson River. A lot of unhappiness about the way they'd been treated and were about to be treated by Congress. There was a very real effort to get the army to march on Congress and throw the bums out, basically seize power. There was even talk about declaring George Washington king. And Washington basically got everyone, all the officers together in a room and talked them off the ledge and said, you know, I've grown old in the service of my country, basically promising to look after the soldiers and get them to just end this threat. But it was very real and, you know, the consequences could have been unimaginable.
And that was the last time, 1700s.
I would say that was the last real time, yes. I mean, the U.S. always had this antipathy to the idea of a standing army until quite modern times. The military was tolerated, and the military as an institution knew that to maintain their existence, they had to inculcate this notion that the military has to be subservient to the civilian authority. And it was one of the first armies to actually, like, make sure that every army graduate, you know, knew that.
My British colleague Chris Wolfe teaching me about American history. Thanks a lot, Chris.
You're welcome, Carol.
It's official. The Central Bank of Nigeria has announced that because of a combination of low oil prices and a weak currency, Nigeria is now in a recession. But for months, Nigerian kitchens have been suffering from another catastrophe, a nationwide tomato shortage. As Julia Simon reports, some Nigerians think they can learn a bigger lesson from the tomato crisis.
If you want to know how much Nigerians love tomatoes, all you have to do is listen to a few Nigerian love songs. My tomato Jossie, oh, I don't yet think about you. Have you seen my beautiful baby?
Have you seen my tomato baby? Oh, have you seen my beautiful baby? Have you seen my tomatoes, baby? Oh?
This is Laurie Richards singing a song by pop star Flavor. She says sometimes Nigerian men compare beautiful women to beautiful Nigerian tomatoes.
You know, Nigerian men, they like hiding their feelings. They don't come out openly to tell you the way they feel.
So instead they call you a tomato.
Somehow.
Tomatoes are prized in Nigeria. You find them in jollof rice, in stews. Well, you used to. Laurie is a caterer here in Abuja. And at a recent wedding, her salads looked different. In the salad, did you have any tomatoes?
No.
I wouldn't even try it. It's a no-go area for us.
A no-go area?
Yes, of course.
Then she gets serious.
But for real, it's not funny at all. People can no longer eat stew. They just do their normal white rice or fried rice. That's what is in vogue now.
Laurie wanted to show me how hard it was to find tomatoes, so she took me to the market. We found one vendor, Abba, washing the few gnarly-looking tomatoes he had. He said there used to be 10 vendors here, and the prices have soared. He showed me a basket that used to be 500 naira. It used to be 500, and now it's...
5,000 or 4, 5.
Wait a second. It's 10 times the price. Initially, Nigerians suspected the shortage was the result of someone trying to corner the market. But it wasn't that.
No, it wasn't.
Biodun Claudius Cole is a crop protection specialist at the University of Ibadan, and she says the culprit was actually a moth, Tuta absoluta.
The pest eats up the green of the leaves, so what you have at the end of the day is just a blanched appearance of the leaves.
So this is one of the few times in Nigeria that, in fact, it wasn't a conspiracy.
Exactly.
While a new crop of bug-free tomatoes is starting to appear in markets, Dr. Cole expects prices won't fully return to where they were. And that's because of oil. Nigeria used to get most of its foreign currency from the oil sector. But with the low oil price, militant attacks in the Niger Delta, the oil dollars aren't coming in. Now the country simply doesn't have the dollars to buy things from abroad. For farmers, that means a struggle to import things like tractors and pesticide, and a reason to keep tomato prices up. But with the high price of tomatoes, there might be a silver lining. Because suddenly, the national conversation isn't just about oil, it's about produce.
This is one of the few times that scarcity of a commodity has generated so much attention to the point that it caught the attention of the president.
Von Kamedi agrees, and he says it's an opportunity. He's a former activist and consultant turned rice farmer. And he says with this crisis has come a national soul searching about diversifying the economy.
Everyone has been talking about tomatoes, but I think more broadly, the tomato situation made us to reflect more on how little we are doing in the agricultural sector, at least compared to the size of our country and our potential.
He says agriculture is a way not just for Nigeria to get foreign exchange through exports, but also become less vulnerable to the volatility of oil. Kamedi says some of his friends now plan to move out of the oil economy and into agriculture. And Kamedi himself says he's not just planting rice, he's planting tomatoes. For the world, Julia Simon, Abuja, Nigeria.
A preview for a story we'll hear tomorrow here on The World. Over 20 years ago, protesters blockaded a road in British Columbia, Canada, and started the War on the Woods. That led eventually to the protection of a place called the Great Bear Rainforest. It's the largest coastal temperate rainforest in the world. So how did environmentalists, logging companies, and Aboriginal groups come together to save the Great Bear? Well, it wasn't easy.
It's kind of like having children. If you knew what was ahead of you when you started, you would never do it.
The battle for the Great Bear Rainforest. That's tomorrow on The World. And just ahead, a Syrian swimmer goes from refugee to Olympic hopeful. This is The World. The 2016 Summer Olympic Games officially get underway Friday in Rio. And we're still hearing about how the host city is struggling to get everything ready. But there's a bigger issue to worry about, security. The Olympics have been attacked before. Think Munich in 1972 or Atlanta in 1996. So it's disturbing to hear that ISIS extremists have started posting propaganda messages in Portuguese. The militant group wants lone wolves to attack the Rio Games. Brazil's been preparing, though, with help from the U.S. Robert Mugga is a specialist in security and development. He's head of the Igarapé Institute in Rio. Robert, how are Brazil and the U.S. working together?
Well, there's been a fair bit of cooperation that goes back a number of years, really around the time that Brazil was awarded the Olympics in 2009. So there's intelligence sharing that's been going on, both between the formal military intelligence, but also between the federal police of both countries. There's been preparation on the ground in terms of training Brazilians for dealing with chemical or biological attacks. And Brazilians have actually gone to the United States to check out things like the Boston Marathon or big mega events being held in the United States to get a sense of how the U.S. goes about doing it.
Will the U.S. be helping Brazil during the actual games with things like surveillance?
Absolutely. I mean, the United States has been supporting in monitoring cyberspace, not just of extremist, terrorist type elements like ISIS or Al-Qaeda, but also extreme left-wing and anarchist groups, including Anonymous, the hacktivist collective, for example, that have also launched an operation to disrupt the games. So the Brazilians will be counting, I think, on the United States as well as many others to monitor a whole range of diverse threats.
Given what you know, how confident are you in Brazil's ability to keep the game safe?
When it comes to physical deployment, Brazil has launched an unprecedented security operation. There are more than 85,000 military and police that are being deployed. And that doesn't include the many municipal guards, the private security groups, and the international law enforcement actors that are going to be on the ground. It set up a really robust counterterrorism center in Rio itself. This is the first of its kind for games. And it's designed really comprehensive cyber defense capabilities, including additional surveillance conducted through balloons and remotely circulating drones. So when it comes to protecting from
balloons, what are the balloons doing?
Well, the balloons actually are carrying different kinds of surveillance equipment, including cameras and microphones that will allow for a sort of 360, 24/7 overview of what's going on the ground.
Will people see them? If you look up, will you see balloons floating around?
That's right. You might see them off in the distance. So there are four enormous balloons that will be circulating over the entire spread of the city. So these kinds of technological innovations that we haven't seen before, I think, are being tried out in trial for the first time. I think what Brazil has prepared for, in a way, is an organized-style, foreign-launched-style attack from a terrorist group. I think the challenge that the Brazilians and international actors are going to face is that the likely threat, if there is to be some kind of attack, will be of an asymmetric nature. It will be of potentially a remotely radicalized, recently converted Brazilian who maybe wasn't on the radar, the watch list of 100 alleged suspects that currently the intelligence here are using. So the concern is that the actual form and functions of the counterterrorist response may not be properly configured for the type of asymmetric threat that might actually emerge.
Robert Mugga heads the Igarapé Institute, a security think tank in Rio. Thanks, Robert.
Thanks so much.
Finally today, I want to tell you about one of the athletes who'll be competing in Rio. Up until about 2 years ago, Yusra Mardini was still an iPhone-wielding, Nike-attired teenager in Syria, despite the war there. And she was also a great swimmer. Then life in the war zone simply became too unbearable. Yusra convinced her parents to let her and her sister leave Syria for Europe. Eventually, they got on a boat to Lesbos, Greece. But 3 hours into the trip, the boat lost its engine. Panic ensued. I'll let my BBC colleague Katerina Moe pick up from here. She spoke with Yusra and wrote about her story.
So one of the guys stepped in and said everyone who could swim had to get out of the boat into the water just to lighten the load. And everyone's belongings got thrown overboard. She said that she held onto the boat with one hand on one side. Her sister was on the boat on the other side of the boat. And they were doing breaststroke and sort of just trying to cling on. The waves were so rough, and she said about seven waves hit her. And
What happened to the rest of the people on the boat?
So everyone was praying on the boat. The ones who could swim, there were three people who had to get out of the boat, and the others had to stay in the boat, and they were bailing water out just to try and keep it afloat. The mission was to get to Lesbos.
Did everyone make it to Lesbos?
Everyone made it to Lesbos, yes.
Now, Yusra gets to Germany, and how does she connect with other swimmers and get that part of her life going again?
So Yusra arrives in Munich first and then ends up in a refugee camp in Berlin. And she was put in touch with an Egyptian translator. Others said that he was quite useful in helping them get back on their feet. So she told him, like, my sister and I, we're both swimmers, because her sister's also a very good swimmer. And please, can you find us a club so that we can train at? And he agreed, but he also said, he goes, can you actually swim? Are you sure you're good enough? Please don't embarrass me. And the way she told it was just so amusing. She said, yes, no, I swear, I promise, just find me a club. I promise you I'm a good swimmer. And so he did, and he took them to the Westfreunde Spandau Club. which is based at the Berlin Olympic Park, built by the Nazis, and put her in touch with Sven Spanakrebs, who is now her coach. He and a few others watched their technique, and they were impressed with what they saw, and they actually couldn't believe that the girls had learned to swim in Syria. They thought perhaps that they'd honed their technique in America or somewhere, in a, you know, not from Syria or the Middle East.
So I understand that Coach Sven, he was thinking of kind of grooming them for the Tokyo Olympics, but then the option for the refugee team turned up.
Yeah, so Yusra's training has been, even though she's a very good swimmer, her training was severely disrupted when she was in Syria, particularly in the final 2 years before she left for Germany. And so the goal was always to get a sort of medal level for Tokyo. But that's also because she had to apply for a German citizenship as well. So what this team refugee team allows people, asylum seekers who don't have a country, to compete under the Olympic flag and under the IOC anthem as well. And this sort of provided hope for many athletes like Yusra, runners in Kenya. We had some judoka athletes in Brazil also, to go to the Olympics.
How's Yusra feeling about going to the Olympics in Rio?
She is excited. She's there right now. I've been speaking with her coach, been following her on Instagram. She is so excited. She always hoped that she would go to the Olympics one day, but I don't think she ever imagined that she would be in Rio competing.
My BBC colleague, Katerina Moe, telling us about Yusra Mardini, the Syrian swimmer who'll be competing at the Olympics. Thanks, Katerina.
Thank you.
And that's it from us today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH, I'm Carol Hills. Back tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.